Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network and our program moving forward on the third Sunday of each month. I'm your host, Kelly KJ Jones, brain injury survivor and now life coach. My co-host, Dr. Valentina, she is a bilingual clinical psychologist, and she's here to discuss the emotional aspects that coincide beyond physical injuries. Moving forward, we'll host discussions with persons who have experienced neuroinflammation and certified clinicians who have assisted survivors. Their insight on discovery, the line between pain tolerance and pain threshold, as well as pathways to success, will provide hope and more options on how to build momentum for sustainable recovery. Let me see. Dr. Valentina?
Yep, I'm here.
Yay! That's awesome! Awesome! I missed you!
I know. I missed you too. I missed the show. Like, I can't believe last month. Like, I don't know. I guess we both just needed that. But I'm so glad we're back. I really did miss you. I missed the show as well.
Yeah. So now we got 2 months of stories. Tell me something that happened. I know at least one thing had to happen to you over the past 2 months. Tell me something new.
Yeah. Well, honestly, a lot has happened, but one thing I can say is that I added a clinician to my practice so that now instead of being an individual practice, we're a group practice and actually two clinicians. So there's three of us now, which is super exciting because basically it means that when clients, you know, request testing or therapy services, I don't have to turn them down. I can refer them to one of my on-site clinicians who's trusted, who's, you know, very well equipped to handle whatever, you know, issue they present. So that's like exciting because I never pictured, first of all, going in private practice this young, and second of all, like creating, like developing a group practice out of this. Like, I love it. I love what the Father's doing.
Wow, that is awesome. That is so awesome.
Thank you.
I'm really happy for you. So for me, gosh, you name it, it has happened over the past 2 months, but because so much has happened over the past 2 months, I'll tell you the coolest thing that happened today.
Yes.
The gentleman that introduced my parents, my dad's best friend, I ran into him about 2 months ago, and he's like, you know, you got to come over for dinner. You got to come over for dinner. You know, my mom's deceased. My dad's deceased. I'm an only child. So, you know, you got to come do the Sunday dinner. And I went over to his house today. And, man, oh, man, there is nothing like conversing with someone who knows you. Like, he knew my – like, when I walked in, his wife was like, oh, yeah, you're the little girl that used to talk a lot.
Wow.
But, yeah, my parents actually, my mother actually named his son. He married my parents. So, wow. You know, like you said, you know, God knows how to fill those voids, you know, those surrogates come into play. So I'm just grateful. That's the biggest thing, that, or the newest thing, but there's just so many things that have happened along the way. So, but let me tell you what's going to happen tonight. Are you ready for this?
I am.
All right. I know you are. I know you are. Raise the roof. We are going to be talking to you. We're going to be talking to Elizabeth Gerald tonight, a powerful, powerful, powerful story of moving forward, stories of triumph, as we talk about healing ourselves and healing others around us. Elizabeth's daughter, Marcy Gerald, she, the 2012 preteen beauty pageant state finalist, an accomplished violinist, NBC's producers selection for a show empowering young girls, and community volunteer. She smiled on the outside while grappling with pain on the inside. The day after Marcy's 15th birthday, a gang member beat and then sexually assaulted Marcy, leaving indelible emotional scars. Marcy tried to scrub herself clean. I mean, literally scrub herself clean. But the emotional scars remained. She attended therapy, but it could not erase the core of her pain. The night before she died, she lay in her mother Elizabeth's arms and told her that she loved her. After Marcy's death, Elizabeth developed the Marcy Janaea Movement, MJM, to address depression following brutal sexual assault. MJM's educational and mental health partners utilize the RULER approach to optimize cognitive growth, relational growth, and creative growth. Most recently, Elizabeth Gerald has received a letter of condolence from Michelle Obama, and the presidential award from the Biden administration. Elizabeth, are you here with us?
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
You are. Thank you so much for joining us, Elizabeth.
Hey, Elizabeth. Hey, how are you? I'm doing good. It's so great to hear your voice. Oh, you too.
All right, turn up on the air. Turn up. Yes. So, Elizabeth, you are a hero in many ways. I've looked at your information, your letters from Obama, from Michelle Obama, your presidential award, so many things that you're doing here today. I read up on the RULER approach. You are amazing, and
I'm so
glad that you're here tonight, because your story is going to help a lot of people along the way. One of the things that I found interesting about you growing up is that you were a cheerleader, so you know about making everybody else happy.
Yeah. That was many moons ago, over 30 years ago. Yeah,
well, look,
at least
you could do the cartwheel and the split. Do you think?
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Yes. Elizabeth, do you think that's like a part of your makeup, like basically just making people happy? Like, where did all that start? Where did all that come from? Because it takes a lot to be a cheerleader. They told me no on the first tryout, so.
Oh man.
Tell me a little bit about growing up and becoming a cheerleader and getting to that point.
When I was in high school, I was just, you know, a rather high school girl. I liked it to dance and cheer, and you know, I was into cartwheels and gymnastics, too, and I think that's how I was in gymnastics first. So one thing just led to another.
Wow.
Used to do the bars and the horse. I was really good with those.
Wow.
So, you know.
Wait, that sounds more like gymnastics. Wait.
Yeah, that's why I said I was in gymnastics first, eventually.
There you go. Okay. Oh,
yeah, one leg to the other.
Easier because you could, you know, oh, man, okay.
So was your team any good, Elizabeth? The team that you cheered for, were they good or were they good or were they bad?
Well, you know, I was a homophobic from high school, so it was a very good school. So,
I have clients out there, actually. I know that it's still good, actually.
And you know what's crazy? When I went there, it might have been 10 black people in the whole school at that time. Literally.
Now it's like that. Probably more the, well, what you say? Is it more the opposite?
Yeah,
or
it's
no?
more of us out there now.
Yeah, okay. Wow.
Times really changed.
Times have changed. That's right.
Wow, but you still had to move the crowd.
Yeah.
And keep everybody up. Yeah. You know, that is a special gift, being positive and finding the opportunity or finding the brighter side of the coin, you know, when things around you may not look like the brighter side, but, you know, just the ability to encourage others along the way and see that there could be a more favorable outcome.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
You know what, though? That's how I was raised, though, to just be positive. Because, you know, coming up and, you know, in moments, it was a fine. You know, I would see, you know, because I lost my mom, my natural mom, at a young age. And my dad was killed when she was pregnant. So my dad's mom and dad, my grandparents actually raised me, and they had a farm in moments. And you would see how, you know, they're just, it's like different. You know, they would help each other. They would trade crops or, you know, somebody might need eggs and somebody might give them fruit or meat or whatever. But they shared. It wasn't like it is now, you know. And then I did move to the suburbs because that was the rural area. And then, you know, when we did move to the suburbs and stuff, and it was a lot different, you know, because we didn't even have, I didn't start drinking regular milk till I moved to the suburbs.
Yes. Wow.
So I still drink canned milk because canned milk tastes more like cow milk than like 2% of whole milk do.
Yeah.
Oh, you sound like my parents. Oh, my gosh, with the canned milk.
I don't really like cow milk. I mean, I don't like the 2% or the whole milk, but canned milk tastes more like cow milk. I mean, it tastes more like it than the full bar milk you buy. You know what I'm saying?
Wow.
And there is something to, you know, that wholesome life where you have, like, canned milk, but beyond that, you also have so much support and encouragement around you so that, you know, I think of, I'm getting ready to go biblical for a second. Remember when, it was Moses was standing and they were fighting a particular army. I'm not going to go too biblical because I can't remember everything, but basically he was tired. And Aaron and her held his arms up. Remember Aaron on one side and her on the other side? And as long as his arms were held up, they were able to defeat the enemy. But when his arms started to droop, the enemy was able to once again attack the Israelites. And so I just think that, you know, of that type of bonding and that type of support that a family can provide as far as like holding up your arms. And keeping you through tough situations. It doesn't mean that the tough situation isn't there, but it just means that you have support while going through.
Exactly. So it was a lot different then than it is now. I just, we don't help each other like we, and I still try, but, you know, I was told, I was helping somebody with a friend, and he asked me to introduce him to one of my friends that's a judge. So I introduced her to a judge, and she ended up telling one of her friends that, it's a shame how everybody uses Elizabeth because she knows all these powerful people, but she's so gullible. She says, it's a shame how people use it because I'm so gullible just to get to the powerful people I know. And I was like, wow. So I was like, That's why I step back and really don't do a lot. I do a lot of solo dolo myself now. It's too much. And these are black women that were saying this, not white.
But you know what, Elizabeth? You know what? This kind of reminds me a little bit of when clients, you know, like they'll say, oh, you know, I go into work and this particular woman doesn't speak when I speak, and so I'm not going to speak anymore. And I always, you know, when I hear stuff like that, I'll encourage a client, like, no, don't let anybody change you. Sure, I'm going to meet you halfway, right? And I'm going to say, you know, don't go out your way maybe to, like, talk to that woman. You know, but like, you know, by for example, hey, Gio, like maybe don't go out your way to say something like that, but surely you go in the building and you greet people the way you would normally greet. Good morning, everybody. Mm-hmm. Good morning. Hi. You know, and so it's the same in your case. Like, don't let anybody change you. Like, they're what they're doing almost on some level is pathologizing the good that you're doing by saying you're gullible when really you're just being kind. Like, if you're saying somebody's wanting to know a judge and you know a judge and you're like, oh, I know a judge. Here's a number. Or here, you know what I mean? So, like, I mean, if you see, if you believe that you are gullible, then it is what it is. But if you don't necessarily, if you don't believe you are, then don't let nobody pathologize some good thing that you're doing. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And change what you're doing, like in the end. You know what I mean? If a person didn't get that contact from you and cut you off, then you keep doing what you're doing, right? Like,
No, I cut her off because after she said that, the judge didn't cut me off, but the person who said it, Delise, I cut her off.
There you go. So, there you go.
You know, I'm so gullible and I'm easy to use. You will never be able to use me again. Mm-mm.
I know that's right.
You know what? The only thing I was going to say is that sometimes your plate can be so full until one more complaint or one more negativity or one more whatever can set you by going backwards. I'll just put it that way. I'm not going to use words. I'm just going to break it down. Right? We're supposed to keep things at survey level, right? It can keep you. It can cause you to start moving backwards. So when you know you're at that point that something can actually make you act out of character, sometimes it is good to remove yourself. I mean, I know that, you know, and I don't want this to be about me, Elizabeth, but I will say this quick thing. I know that growing up, I was the one, I'm an only child, and I was always encouraged to make others happy. But there came a point in time where I realized that I was just being, I was being used. Like, I would give the idea that everybody else would get the credit. You know, I would, you know, if I did something wrong, I would apologize over and over and over and over and over again. And some people, you know what, you just got to let it go. You know, God doesn't tell us to beg for forgiveness. We never saw Jesus beg for forgiveness. He tells us to apologize. And if someone cannot accept that, then you shake the dust off your feet and you keep it moving, right? That's the only obligation. So I say that to say that, you know, as an encourager, as you were stating that you were beforehand, Elizabeth, I understand your desire to be in a positive environment. And those words of negativity can, you know, cause you to, you know, think twice, you know, remove yourself from that environment temporarily. I get it. I get it. And I see it with kids. When I work with kids a lot of times, because they are the younger ones and the adults are the elders, when the elders say things that are very critical, and we don't think that they get it. We don't think that they're the empath that they are. I see them regress and move away from the crowd, you know? Let me ask you this. Something very traumatic happened to Marcy. I don't know if you want to, how much of the story you want to tell us, but what happened, in your words, to Marcy?
Well, what essentially happened with her, like we were saying before, she was an honorable student. She was in a teen pageant, actually a state finalist. She was in a band at school. She played the violin. She had, had just did an interview with NBC. I sent you the picture. She just said did the interview with NBC for the empowerment show that they were coming out with. So she had a bright future. She actually wanted to graduate and go to Harvard and be a Supreme Court justice, be the first. You know what? Kataji is actually the same person. It's like almost the same path. Kataji lived in Florida and Marcy lived in Flossmoor, and they both black women. And, you know, Marcy wants to go to Harvard, and Kataji did go to Harvard, and Marcy wants to be the first black woman Supreme Court justice, and Kataji did. First, you know what I'm saying? So it's almost like,
wow.
So I see a lot of Marcy in her. But, you know, Marcy was, she got to book, bake and cook and, you know, volunteer to feed the homeless and, you know, just a regular teen girl that did, you know, tried to do as things she could to get good grades and stay positive and productive, because that's how we were. And then she, what essentially happened with that was she was, you know, she would stay after school for sports, whatever else. And most times my son or somebody would walk home with her or her friends. But the guy had, it was a guy who had just gotten out of prison, Illinois Department of Corrections. And he was supposed to register in Chicago, but he didn't. Mm-hmm. Somehow or another, his parole officers, I guess they assigned so many parolees, and I guess he just got too many of them and didn't realize that he had didn't register. So he ended up coming back to the suburbs. And I'm assuming they just give him, like, bus tickets or some bus fare or something to get to Chicago. But instead of going to wherever he's supposed to go, he came out to the suburbs. And, you know, I'm not clear when he seen my daughter or the day or nothing. We just know he spotted her, and he waited until he caught her alone. And when he caught her alone, he brutally beat her, and then he sexually assaulted her. He left her, yep. And she had her phone, and she managed to dial 911. And the Flossmoor police got her, and they took her to the hospital. And then they came back. The detectives came back and got me. And they didn't tell me what had happened at first. They just said she had been in an accident. So I'm thinking she didn't got hit by a car, because the school is on Kennedy, which is like an expressway, a highway. And so I thought maybe she had got hit by a car or something, or maybe she fell, hurt herself. You know, just something simple. That was not what I was expecting. And I didn't know if she was sexually assaulted. So I got to the hospital, and they were saying they were waiting on her. I think it's called a Kerr's nerve. They were waiting on that, and I'm like, well, what is that? And then that's when they told me what had happened, and I was just like, wow. And when I went to go see her, you know, she was crying and everything. It was just a lot. That day was just a whole lot. And then the nurse came and examined her, and they was able to find him because his DNA and everything was in her, so they were able to get his DNA. They caught him pretty quickly because he had nowhere to go. They got him. And, you know, I will say this. I know there's a lot going on with the police department, but in this case, they couldn't have been any nicer and any more professional. They came and got me. The state's attorney met me at the police department. They wrestled me. My daughter was afraid to go outside after what happened. They would call me and say, "Have you guys eaten yet? You want to order out? Or just bring us food by there." I mean, they went above and beyond the call of duty. They didn't have to do that. And I didn't ask them, but, you know, just to show support them. And, you know, my community was very supportive of it. So they did get him. And he actually admitted to everything he did. It wasn't like he was trying to hide or nothing. He admitted, but he just, I don't know. They said he was retired. They said he had a low IQ and all this mess. I just think he's full of crap. He'd been in jail, so he probably knew what to say and what to do. Just seemed like they come up with the excuse because he would laugh and stuff. He just very ignorant when he was acting in court. Kept laughing and winking and stuff like a kid. So I think he did that on purpose. I do.
To play into the role of having some kind of intellectual disability.
Something wrong, right?
I see.
Right.
Okay.
So you know, I think, you know, when they're in jail, you know, when they're in jail like that, they talk, they teach each other stuff, and they teach each other how to do this and do that and how to get away with stuff because people didn't did it. So we got tired of going, and so we ended up asking for a plea deal, and they gave him 10 years in life parole. They said, "Don't worry, because even if he don't register, he'll go right back." So I'm like, you know, so we were done with it, and when it was his turn to speak, because, you know, everybody thought he was going to apologize because he did want to speak, and he just said, "If he wasn't so beautiful, I wouldn't have been attracted to you, so you have nobody to blame but yourself, because I couldn't help myself."
Oh, my God.
And then they took him out of there. Yep. So here
so
that,
he told
you know,
your daughter that she, because she was attracted, she's to blame for what he did? That's what you said? Blame was the word you
Yeah, that's what he said, because he couldn't help himself. So,
That
kind of pushed her over the edge, because, you know what I'm saying, it was already traumatic what she went through. She was a virgin and everything. So, you know, he's telling, you know, 14-year-old this, and it was just a lot.
Wow. This is the kind of stuff that, like, just confuses and angers people, because it's like, even like we have a criminal justice system in place to protect people, to keep order, right? And and it's just dumb. Like, why would they make a child go to, because it sounds like you said the child was being tired of going to hearing after hearing and seeing this.
Yeah, because we were in the same courtroom, and he was in the front and we were in the back. But and that's not just us, the murder victims, all of us, just that we're in the same courtroom.
What was
your daughter saying to you during the process? Like when you went home, what was she saying?
You know, she would cry, be upset, sit in her room. I would always make an appointment for her to see Dr. Summer Matheson, you know, around that date, you know, either before, you know, try to get her in right, you know, after we go to court or maybe a day or two afterwards.
Is this a psychologist? This is a psychologist, like a therapist?
Yeah, she was a therapist, yeah.
Okay.
And have her go in and, you know, get her counseling and stuff. And, you know, it was bad to the point where she was afraid to go outside and because he had gang affiliations with GDs. So they ended up sending her.
Oh, you say he was gang affiliated? Oh, GD, like Gangster Disciples. Okay, so she was afraid to leave the
Larry Hoover gang, the one they're trying to get out of jail because he's a political prisoner. His gang.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. Kanye and all these rappers going around talking about free Larry Hoover, but and he's in jail, so I can't blame him for what these dudes are doing, but. You know, he wasn't right for our community. None of them are they. I mean, he's been in jail his whole life. I get it, his wife and family wants him home, but he shouldn't have did what he did, period. But it's his game.
As she's going through this therapy, what are you going through?
They did family counseling. They would do individual and family. They would come to our house and do family, and then we would go there and we'd do individual.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So we all had our own therapist up there. They seen all of us, and the Home of Foster School District. What they did was they found a therapeutic school from RC in Naperville called the Mansion. And it's for girls, you know, who have been sexually assaulted. And, you know, even though it's at a therapeutic school, you still had to, you know, keep a high GPA score in order to stay there, you know what I'm saying, because they still wanted the girls to graduate and go to college or whatever. So that was a good program. That's a good program, but you have to be on the honor roll to go to that program.
Was that an issue for her or no? That wasn't an issue for Marcy.
She scrambled down even more. After the sexual assault, she was sitting in the tub for hours just scrubbing herself raw. And it would get to the point where I had to put Neosporin and, you know, because she would just scrub herself to the point where, you know, she would be bleeding and stuff down there. And you'd have to get creams and stuff and for the doctor, and it was very traumatic for her. And after he said that to her, she went down even more. And a few days later, you know, I was just doing laundry because I was so upset, but I couldn't let her, you know, I'm just, you know, I couldn't let her see me. So I had to compose myself. I couldn't let her see me upset and angry. So I was just doing laundry up and downstairs doing laundry. And she had been in her room that whole day. And I kept checking on her, like, are you hungry? She would say no. So then around 10, she had asked me to run her some bath water. She wanted lavender oil and chamomile oil. And I put in her bath water. And she was in the tub for maybe an hour. So I checked on her to make sure she was okay. And she says, I'm fine, Mommy. And so when she got out, I had laid down after she got out. And then maybe 30, 45 minutes after she got the tub, she came downstairs and gave me a hug and a kiss and said, I love you, Mommy. I said, I love you, too. And she said, can I lay down with you? I said, yeah. And she laid down. She never woke up again. I woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning. Yep, July 24th, I woke up to wait, you know, to get what I got to do. And I was trying to wake her up because she had fell asleep on top of me. And I said, Marcy, wake up. Nothing happened. And I said again, Marcy, wake up. And still nothing happened. I said, Marcy. And then I sat her up, and then I ran and screamed for my son to come downstairs. And he came down, and he started screaming, Mom, call 911. And I called 911. I said, there's something wrong with my daughter. I can't wake her up. Mm-hmm. They came within maybe a minute and a half. They were there really quick. They later on the floor started doing CPR. I ran the bathroom, washed my face, brushed my teeth. I heard one of the paramedics said, we got to rush into the hospital. I threw on my house shoes. My son ran back downstairs. He said, Mom, what happened? I said, I don't know. So they told me I had to get in the front and ride with the driver. We got to the hospital. There was a doctor and like three or four nurses outside. They, you know, and they ran her. And I'm visually impaired. I'm actually legally blind. So, you know, I was trying to run behind them, but I started tripping. So one of the nurses came and got me and took me in through the emergency room doors, and she sat me down. And she said, let me go see what's going on. So I said, okay. She went, and then she came back a few minutes later and said, the doctor needs you to stop calling your family. And this is like 6 o'clock in the morning, so I didn't have a purse or a phone or nothing. So she said, give me the names and numbers you want me to call. So I did. I gave my sister's and my niece's number. So she went and called, and when she came, she said, your family members are all on the way. I said, okay. I said, well, what's going on with Marcy? You know, I mean, does she need surgery? What happened? Is she in a coma? I didn't know what had happened. So she said, well, let me go see what the doctor is saying. So she went, and then, you know, a few minutes later, her, the doctor, and a third person came in and said, Ms. Joe, we need to talk to you. And I said, okay. So then at this time, we're going, they take me to this small room. And you know, it's not even dawning on me that we're in a small room. And then the third person and four, right, the third person informed me that he was a chaplain. And even when he said that, I'm still like, well, what's going on with Marcy? Is she okay?
Yes.
And the doctor told me to have a seat. And he said, your daughter expired, and there was nothing else we can do. He said, we tried everything. He said, we even stuck something down her throat and then put her up to some machine to get her heart to beat in, and it didn't even work.
Wow.
And it was like I was in the twilight zone. I just could not believe what they had just said. It was like, what? You know, it didn't seem real.
Wow.
So I asked, could I see her? And they said, yeah. They told me I couldn't hug or kiss her because she had to have a full autopsy to see what had happened.
Yeah.
So my sister ended up making it up there, and, you know, they were just like crying and stuff. And my niece was like, get the F out of here. What the heck? And I'm Then they said, you can stay until the coroner get here, and the coroner usually takes hours. Girl, the coroner took 25 minutes to get there, literally. They took 25 minutes. They were there in 25 minutes. The nurse said they'd never come that quick. It was just very bizarre. I couldn't believe it.
You figured you have more time with her. That was your point, right? In saying
you thought we were going to be able to spend at least a couple of hours or something because I was going to have my son come up there, but we didn't even have time to do that. They had he came in and he asked us stuff out. And
before you continue, Marcy, I just want you to I just want you to just pause for a minute and just, like, sort of get in touch with even the feelings that you have right now, because this is, like, I know you may be used to telling your story, but this is, like, this is a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a lot. This is a lot. Like, we're professionals, and we sitting here like, wow, like, this is a lot, you know? How are you feeling right now as you just kind of share your experience with, I don't know, 50,000
You know, it's like it's so much worse. You have anger, you know, the pain, you're the crying. It's, you know, you almost every emotion that you can think of, it's just, and, you know, you have so much anger towards the person, and, you know, then if you hurt because you mentioned your child, and it's a lot.
And confusion, right? Because you're, like, puzzled. Like, no, how is this possible? Like, I just spoke with her. You couldn't even say 12 hours ago. Like, y'all was in a bed together at 11:30 or something.
Right. And you know what's crazy is that I tell people she came out the world, that she left the world same way she came in. When I had her and they cut the cord before her dad could get up to the hospital, they laid her on my chest and she peed. And then when she died and she laid on my chest, she peed. I thought the puppy had peed on because my neighbor gave me a puppy for being an honorable student. And I thought the puppy had peed, but she had actually peed on me.
Wow. And still there, right there on your chest, like with you, because you said she was laying on you because you was trying to tell her, like, okay, babe, it's time to get up, like, wake up.
Yeah, right.
And that is so powerful when you think of the fact that sometimes when this happens, parents wonder, you know, did I do enough? you know, was she angry with me? Could I, you know, did she love me? And before Marcy left this earth, she let you know that you did everything you could and she loved you. The thing I spoke with Donna Rogers, her daughter Morgan committed suicide. She has a program called Morgan's Message. And Donna was telling me that she has a program with over, I think it's over 1,000 students. And they work with individuals who have college athletes who are contemplating suicide, have mental health concerns, peer support. And the one thing that she's heard over and over again from people who have attempted suicide, thought about suicide, et cetera, is that they never realized how much the people they left behind would hurt. They never realized the void that they were going to create for others. And so I appreciate you sharing your story, and I really would love for you to continue to share what happened from that point to today, because if knowing that a person's absence can create such a void and so much pain, maybe that's the tool that will get people to think twice. Maybe they just don't realize how much they are loved, you know, and how supportive is that. So I thank you for being vulnerable at this moment, because once again, like I said, people don't know. Sometimes people don't know that they're loved and they're valued and that they have purpose.
And in her case, Marcy, let me just say this, that in her case, she probably knew that she was loved by you. That probably represents a group of people, right? Like there's some that for sure don't know it, and that's part of why they don't want to be here, because they feel unloved. And then there's another group when really it could be that they are on some level that is what's communicated to them. For some, it could be that just because your mom's upset with you doesn't mean that she doesn't love you, right? And then, of course, there's the group of people who know they're loved, but they're so overwhelmed with the feelings of, torment. Because like you said, she had to go to this court. Like, that's just what I can't get out of my mind, because you said it occurred the day of, like, basically, you know? So, clearly something, you know, happened right before she went to bed. But the point is that the day of that, I remember you saying she was in court, y'all was tired of it, and you took a plea deal. So that's telling you, like, he's laughing at her. Like, this is a problem. Why are people even forced to be, like, in the same space as they're perpetrated? Like, that don't even make sense.
Right.
That's the ultimate form of torture, you know?
And see, the thing is, if we don't go to court, then, you know, it's not a good look. And the judge, you know, a lot of times if you don't go to court, they're lenient on them, and they really don't, they might just let them right back out, give them probation or stuff. You know, hey, just give them 7 weeks. Right. Like, okay, if he violates your probation, yes, I want to make sure he did go do some time.
This is the same that's even the parameters. Like, that's ridiculous. Like, who, like I'm sure there's been a bunch of men. I'm certain. I'm not saying I'm sure isn't how we just talk regular in America. No, I am actually certain that child expert psychologists who, like me, have their ABIP, as in board certification in child and adolescent psychology from American Board of Professional Psychology, have spoken, even forensic psychologists have spoken to the court systems about the negative implications of forcing this kind of stuff. This is a terrible culture to require that in that realm of law. That's terrible.
Right. Yeah.
No, but I hear you.
Yes, it is.
Because that is the culture. You were bound. Your hands were tied. You were forced. Like, I'm sure your attorney told you, this is the best thing that we could do to make sure he doesn't do this to somebody else again.
Right. And I wanted her to get justice. And, you know, my case, Marcy didn't know she was loved. Like I said, we did. She was my help. She, you know, she everywhere I went, she was there. She went grocery shopping with me. And, you know, we had a really close bond. And everybody, a lot of people would say, I wish I had a bond with my mom like that. So we were pretty close. I just think it was just too much. And then being told it's your fault that you were beaten and raped is what did it.
Wow.
Yeah. After her death, people would say to me, you know, aren't you embarrassed to talk about it? And you know, it's the stigmas and taboos. And, you know, I guess people were just surprised I didn't have a problem with saying that she died by suicide or committed suicide. And, you know, and, you know, that's my child. So, no, I wasn't embarrassed or ashamed. And they will say, well, black people don't kill themselves. That's what, you know, white people do. And, you know, we don't, I just got a lot of backlash for that. And so what I did was just started doing research, and then you found out, wait a minute, we had more suicides than homicides. And then you started looking into stuff. Yeah, and even with the sexual assaults and stuff. And so I decided to turn my pain into my power and be a voice.
Yeah.
And you know, her legacy, build her legacy, you know, I'm not going to be no Supreme Court justice, nothing like that, but I figured the best way I can honor her is to be a voice and try to save lives and be here for other young black and brown girls. And I mean, you know, I reach out, or, you know, to everybody. I don't do just color, but, you know, just to make sure they know that, you know, there's help out there. You know, you don't have to be afraid or embarrassed to get counseling, or, you know, be embarrassed. Yes. Nothing embarrassed about having to see a psychiatrist, a psychologist, therapist, whoever. You know, if somebody's touching you inappropriately, you know, you don't have to. It's not your fault. And I talk to the parents and all that too, because even now there are so many women that walk around, because back in the day, what goes on in my house stays on. It might have been a brother, uncle, father, boyfriend, whoever. And, you know, the mothers would know about it, but because what goes on in my house stays in my house, they wouldn't say nothing. And a lot of times their mothers were touched, and they didn't get no, just so they figured it was okay because they went through it. So we have so many women walking around with that anger and that pain, and, you know, they say, well, they are angry black women and this, that, and the other, but we all got a story. We all been through something, you know, instead of calling them angry black women or, you know, laughing or saying the stuff that they say, talk to them. Figure out what they've been through. Walk in their shoes. And I'm not just saying it happens to black people. It happens to other people, too. But, you know, it's just the stuff I hear. And, you know, so many people have been through so much stuff. And even with suicide, I've had so many families reach out and say, hey, I lost a brother. I lost a father. I lost my mother. I lost my husband. I lost my wife. I lost my child. And they didn't say nothing because of the stigmas and taboos. They'd rather say cancer or natural cause than that. Because it sounds better. And I say, you know, so more and more people now are speaking on it, but it's crazy, you know, how this is, even with the sexual assaults and stuff. And you know, like right now, so many people say, I feel so bad for R. Kelly, and he should be let out. But I'm going to say this, if they let R. Kelly out, the nation let Giselle out, they should let Harvey Weinstein out and the rest of them, because they all do the same thing he did. I don't understand, you know, in our community, we accept this, and everybody knows who the neighborhood Chester Chester is, and we keep giving him a pass. He got away with it, and he beat a case once. You can't keep giving a person a pass because they can't read. He knew what he was. He was a grown man. He's the one that had the most to lose. He let his money and his power go to his head. I don't care if he could read or not. That man knew what he was doing. He just didn't care because he had money and power. So I can keep paying people off. And that's as simple as that. But, you know, you hear so many black women, oh, my God, I just feel so sorry. It's the parents' fault. It's this person's fault. And that's what's going on. And that's what happened. And it just irritates. No, it's not. It's his fault. He chose to do it. Unless somebody put a gun to his head and said, you're going to sleep with my child, fault him. I don't care if the parents brought him or who brought him. He could have said, no, get your child out of my house.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. That's funny. Go ahead, Kelly.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say really quickly, it just goes back to, you know, my teaching experience. For 3 years, I substitute taught, and I wanted to teach at every single school in Wake County, North Carolina, because I wanted to hear from students. And there's so much pain that kids have that is layered pain from different things. You know, it could be bullying. It could be something at home. It could be, you know, emotional scars, you know, physical abuse, sexual abuse, it could be anything, but they have so many layers of pain that they've been told, you know, put on your big girl panties or stick your chest out and don't be a man and you don't cry and don't do this. And what I find is I grew up in Parsippany, New Jersey, and people make, you know, you the white girl, you think you're better than, all this other kind of stuff. No, God blessed me with an opportunity to see both worlds. I was born in East Orange, which is 99% black, and then I you know, went to high school in Parsippany, and the difference is that if one of my white friends broke a fingernail, their parents had them up in the ER checking it out. I mean, if the wind right. blew the wrong way, they were up in the ER making sure that their child was okay. And so what happens is they're not afraid to say when something's wrong. They're not afraid to say, hey, look, you know what? This has happened to me. He touched me. He, you know, whatever it may be, you know, they're bullying me. They're not afraid to say that because they're taught very early on to say what's wrong, and they're nurtured and supported. And I say this, and oh, Lord, I know I'm going to get myself in trouble, but when I was teaching in the high school, I found a lot of the black male athletes were dating white women. And I asked, and there's a nurturing experience that comes from the white women because that's how they're taught at home. And a lot of the African-American women, you know, went through trauma and they could not provide some of the support or some of the coddling that was needed at that time. And it kind of even goes back to, and I'm just using that black-white scenario, but we can go back to your life on the farm where you got that support and that nurturing, and you knew that if something went wrong, there was an auntie, an uncle, a cousin, a neighbor, or someone to support you. And sometimes we don't have that.
Right.
And that's because people around us are hurting so much until their hurt impedes them helping other people. Does that make any sense?
Mm-hmm.
So when you have broken people all around you, you can't keep asking broken people to help you because they need to get out themselves. So with all that being said, like I said, there are some families that are really grappling with, you know, their child's depression, their child's PTSD, you know, all these things that are going on with their children. And I'm sorry, I ate broccoli. I shouldn't have done that, right? But they're grappling with what's going on in their family.
Right.
And can we take one pause for a second, because I know you get it, and I know you get it, Elizabeth. I know you get it, Dr. Valentina. Mm-hmm. But some of our listeners, can you help them understand the difference between depression and PTSD and how the two are treated? Because I know that, please forgive me, in your bio it says that Marcy had depression, but did she also have PTSD, and where did the two, you know, where did the two intersect? But Dr. Valentina, if you could explain that first, and then Marcy, if you could Elizabeth, if you could talk about that for Marcy, and then also, was there any of that for you? So thank you, Dr. Valentina.
Absolutely, yes. So as some may know, PTSD, so both, first of all, PTSD and depression are internalizing disorders. We have disorders that fall in the internalizing arena, which are the depressions and anxiety disorders, and then you have the externalizing type of disorders, which are more like the disruptive behavior disorders, the stuff where basically you acting out your stuff on somebody else, aggression, anger, you know, blaming other people for your misbehaviors, lying, stealing. And of course, the internalizing behaviors is when you look more inward as opposed to outward at other people, but you look at yourself, you blame yourself. Children tend to do this, right? Like, and so that's why it didn't help when dude said to her that it's your fault that you're so beautiful, the reason is for being the reason why I hurt you, and you know, because children tend to do that anyway. I mean, just think of even like divorces that have nothing to do with children. They'll go back in their minds to thinking like, if only I had taken out the trash that day, if only my parents didn't argue over the fact that I don't do the dishes regularly when I'm supposed to, maybe they wouldn't have divorced, you know. And so you know, I have a client who's 13, and he blamed himself. His family died in the fire, and I won't say when because that could give it away. But he like blamed himself for not like being there to like rescue them when he could too have died of smoke inhalation. Just stuff like that. And so depression, you know, as we know, that's sort of an umbrella term. There's many different depression disorders, depressive type disorders, bipolar disorder, stuff that falls under that, you know, umbrella term, just like anxiety is an umbrella term, with a bunch of different anxiety disorders that fall under that, such as PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. It's saying that after this traumatic event occurred, right, which is the post word, there was a stress reaction. There's also, of course, you know, the agoraphobia. That's the fear of going out of your home, the arachnophobia, fear is probably, like, you know, there's the generalized anxiety disorder, where it seems to be that there's just anxiety around a lot of different types of issues, just like there's panic disorder, you know that sort of physical symptom that kind of feels a lot to people like a heart attack, but really it's, you know, they would say that it's more psychological. It just had this physical, you know what I'm saying, implication. And so it's interesting because with these two being these internalizing type of disorders, you'll notice like somewhat overlap across the two. Like, for example, just think about some of these psychotropic drug commercials, right, for antidepressants. One of the symptoms, of course, the obvious symptom for depression is sad mood, you know, crying spells, anhedonia, which is loss of interest, loss of pleasure and things that would normally bring you interest and pleasure. And it's also loss of concentration, which naturally, you know, if we go to then the anxiety disorder, if you're caught up worried about what's going to happen, right, when you get home, whether it's you're going to argue with your husband, or when you get to school, whether it's the bully's going to bother you, or, you know what I'm saying, whatever it is, that will overwhelm your thoughts so that, or such that you have a hard time concentrating on whatever is actually in front of you. So it's interesting, like the overlap is, it's obvious, you know. And so that's, of course, one of them. Another overlapping symptom could be like the sense of hopelessness that things will get better, maybe even the sense of helplessness that there's anybody out there that can actually help you. And then, of course, even suicidality, like people think that that's a symptom that is sort of belongs to the depression disorder or a depression disorder family, but the family of depression disorders. But no, like there's people who experience anxiety that are just so overwhelmed with the fear that in this hopelessness that it'll get better, that they almost feel that they'd be better off dead, which, you know, of course, is a better thought than like having a plan to hurt yourself, you know. It's hard.
Dr. Valentina, mm-hmm. I love to read up on things before we meet, and I just wanted to mention two things. As far as suicide, just a couple of stats with regards to suicide. Right now, suicide is the second leading cause of death for people between the ages of 15 to 24. Mm. Suicide is the 12th leading cause of death in the U.S. 1.2 million suicide attempts took place in 2020, and 45,979 died of suicide, almost 46,000 people. Let me ask you this. What do you think are, between the two of you, let's just take a couple of guesses. What do you think are the top 10 reasons for suicide? What do you think some of the reasons are?
I don't know who you want to go first.
I was asking both of you, but I can tell you. So one is severe depression. Two, traumatic stress. Three, substance use and impulsivity.
Yeah.
Four, loss of fear of loss, so fear of losing something.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you an example of that one really quickly. There was a gentleman recently who was from India who was seeking a Canadian passport, and he was told it was going to take like weeks to get it, right? So on August 17th, he committed suicide. On August 18th, his passport came in the mail, but he committed suicide because he couldn't get the passport. Hopelessness,
wow.
Chronic pain and illness, a feeling like being a burden to others, like a weight, social isolation, a cry for help. And then also there's accidental suicide. Some people will do things thinking that they can, kind of like a Russian roulette, thinking that they can try it, but you know, they have superpowers and they can survive. So those
I would even think that like overdose would fit in that last one, because it's not like, right, you overdose, you don't necessarily like planned on it. Like, you know, you didn't know that. In some people's cases, right? Like when they're when they're using drugs, like they don't always know that they're going to, you know? Like they're not meaning to,
right,
is my point. That's
right. So how did this tie in with your experience between depression and PTSD? Did they go back and forth, Elizabeth, or was it a steady flow? And how did you transition from that to where you are today, or where you are as an activist, or, you know, where you are in collaborating and getting people to see what you're talking about and work with you?
Well, first I would like to say, well, Marcy did have PTSD and depression, and, you know, she was afraid to go outside, so that's why she went to therapeutic school. It was the bus would pick her up and take her to the school. She was afraid of men. And it got to the point, you know, once we stopped going to court, you know, after the rape, she didn't go anywhere else. That's why they put her in at therapeutic school, because they had to homeschool her until they can get her into the school, because she was afraid to leave the house. Because she thought the GDs were going to come and do something, and so she didn't want to go out. And then, well, she did, she started wearing clothes. Marcy was maybe 100 pounds, so she'd get like an extra large, stuff that was way too big. She wanted to wear dark blue, black, dark green, brown. She never wanted to get her hair done anymore. She never wanted to get her nails done anymore. She would just put her hair in a ponytail, and if she did do it at all, never got her nails done again. And, you know, like I said, the clothes would be big enough for her and maybe me and whoever. I mean, she'd get really big clothes. They were just way too big for her. She never wore nice, pretty clothes anymore. She wore just jogging suits, long sleeves, you know. So that's what she went through as far as that. And it just, even with the therapy in school, and I will say there is no magic pill that they can give anybody, but
yeah.
You know, and there's only so much the doctors can do. They do the best, and she had a great doctor, you know. But, you know, it's by her being so young and her first, you know, a sexual experience or something like that. She had never been hit. She'd never been beaten before. So going through that, it was just, you know, it was something. And you know, if she would have lived, she probably would have maybe gotten better. And so I'll never know. But that's what happened with her. She didn't want to go outside or anything. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, I have my, and it's not just me, it's any parent. Anybody who's lost a child, you have your good days and your bad days. You really don't sleep. Holidays are never the same no more. Birthdays are never the same no more. You kind of isolate yourself. You know, there are days I might be up just scrubbing the walls down and stuff. My son will be like, Mom, you got the whole house clean. Like, wait, we have to open the windows and stuff. Because, you know, it's just, you know, my nerves are there. So, you know, each day is different. And it's not just me, it's any mom. If you get in a room full of moms, they all say the same type of similar stories.
But it does come back periodically. It doesn't just go away.
No, it don't go away. You never get over that. You just never get over it. Like when my daughter first died, I think I could have, you know, I wanted to be at the cemetery all day, every day. Even if I could drive, I would still be at the cemetery every day. But, you know, it's not fair to my kids. They don't want to be in no cemetery every day. But, you know, the first year, it was just hard for me. You know, I had to go there every couple of days, and so I can go there now every couple of months or whatever, clean up her grave and change her grave around or whatever else. And, you know, I think sometimes when people say stuff, or, you know, I was doing a panel, and one of the ladies, she works with, I think, the name of her organization is Kirby, which is they deal with sex offenders and people out of prison. They do mental health for them. And she was saying, saying that, you know, how she thinks she can reform them. And some of them can be reformed. Everybody that's in jail for rape didn't necessarily rape somebody. You have, sometimes the girl might have been 16, the boy might have been 17, or, you know, sometimes people get mad and say he raped me. So I don't, you know, I don't know who she's getting, but she was saying, because I'm also trying to get a law pass, she was saying that, you know, I know how you feel, but, you know, this, that, and the other. And I think I snapped out on her, and I said, no, you don't know how I feel, because it's not you, not your child. And I guarantee if you and yours, you would have your mind of thinking would be totally different. And she just, her daughter looked at her and she didn't say nothing else to me or whatever else. And everybody kind of got quiet, but you know, mood swings and like I said, I'm speaking for all the mothers. It's when you get in a room full of mothers who've lost a child, you just gotta really be, you know, I'm not as bad as a lot of the other mothers. A lot of them will just cuss you out and go out at a you know, snap of a finger. I'm not as bad as those, but because I know how to, you know, handle myself a lot better. But it's just, you know, you just never get over. You will never get over losing your child. Never.
I'm getting ready to go Bible again. I can't remember whose story is in the Bible, but there's a someone who died, and God told the prophet that your wife is going to die tomorrow. Wash your face and keep it moving. Like, you don't have time to grieve. What you got to do is keep going. And when he's calling you to lead a group, you know, or when he's calling you to make transition, you do have to wash your face and keep going. I mean, you will have times of sadness and depression, but you do have to wash your face and keep going because there's a ministry out there and there's so many people who are needing your story. I think it's so beautiful and so powerful that you can tell your story with clarity and transparency, because there are so many youth right now who are not going to listen to you unless if you come at them with clarity and transparency, because their story is so deep. You know, they got layers. They got layers on top of layers. And so if you come in there and you come in mince or you come in soft or whatever, they're like, okay, whatever. Like, you can't relate to me. So what you're doing is so powerful. And I get the, you know, the tough part. And the worst part is, you know who's always going to tell you what you should do? The people with no children, people that don't have any children.
Exactly.
At all. They're always going to tell you what you should do. I'm like, really? Really? There's a reason why you're not. Anyway, I'm not going to go down that road. Come on. But anyway, the point that I'm getting to is I'm hearing the part where you have to, you mentioned the part where you have to, or where you're able to be real, right? And like I said, I'm breathing and I'm in pain. What about those moments where you can't do it? What about those moments where you have to be strong and solid for your other kids, for the community that you're presenting to, et cetera? How are you doing that? What do you think is enabling you to tell your story with so much clarity and transparency and relatability to move Michelle Obama and for you to be president? You know what I mean? That's some deep stuff. I mean,
I always pray and I burn my sage and my incense before I get on in a panel or before I go to any event, you know, and I just pray and I really have to meditate and stuff. And, you know, I always have a picture of my daughter and I always say, well, what would she want me to do? Would she want me to be in here crying and acting fun fool? Would she want me to have class and integrity? Because I'm honoring her. This is her legacy. It's not, you know, even though I'm hurting, this is still her legacy. And I don't want to tarnish her name by, you know, acting a plum fool. And I'm going to just give you a couple examples. We have all these actors. We have Tamika. We have BLM. And, you know, even Attorney Ben Crump. They cause a lot of divisions. There's high profile versus low profile. And, you know, some of the mothers that lost their kids to police shootings are the ones that told me about this. And I had never heard of such thing. What do you mean high profile? And so the mothers who are considered, like Trayvon, his mother's high profile, Sandra Bland's mom's high profile, those mothers, they're high profile. But then you got other mothers who lost their kids to police shootings or other stuff, they're low profile. You have mothers who lost their kids to black-on-black gun violence. You don't even hear about them. And even, you know, like when George Floyd happened, BLM had asked all of us to come stand in solitary with the family. So I went down there. And what I witnessed was, you know, mothers that when, you know, arguing about who has the better events. And I was just in disbelief.
Oh,
you know, Michael Brown's father, Michael Brown Sr. had said he was supposed to come and talk to the low-profile fathers. He said, I'm not coming. I don't F with them niggas. I'm high-profile, which means it didn't want to his head like he's, you know, a god or something. You like, your son is on the ground just like this. Your son ain't no better than their son. And I don't like that. They come, you know, they would come running when the media is there. But the ones who don't get no media, you don't even see them. And, you know, you take Patrice Kuros and BLM, they didn't became millionaires off of people's pain. Half of them people who they didn't got donations for are homeless. They don't even have headstones and stuff for their kids. Oh, yeah, it's a lot of mothers. It's quite a few of those mothers that are homeless, that are struggling. They don't have food. It's a lot of those mothers don't even have headstones and stuff. But they didn't got all kind of donations and they did nothing. That's why so many people like the IRS and you know, a lot of the people that used to donate to them are pulling back because they're not telling people what they did with the money. She kept the money, buying mansions, going on trips and everything, and not helping the families who was, you know, people were donating to. And, you know, the thing for me, I don't do none of that. You know, I do what I say I do. You know, for Marcy, July 20th, it made 7 years that she was dead. July 23rd, we gave away. I partnered with Foot Locker, Chick-fil-A, Wendy's, White Castle's. We gave away book bags, food, over 4,000 gift cards, school supplies. Over 1,000 people came. I wasn't expecting no more than maybe 100 people max, maybe 150. Mm-hmm. They said over 1,000 people, I'm looking around like, you know, more and more people are coming. And it broke me down because I didn't know that many people even knew about my daughter, whatever else. And so many people came out. It was overwhelming because I'm looking like, it's a good thing. But then it was like, wow, I just wasn't expecting that. And we fed everybody. We actually started running out of stuff. And the grace of God, White Castles came and they pulled up Charlotte. They came and brought 800 burgers and Charlie came and brought some gift cards. When, you know, we started running out of stuff and they just started calling. The park district actually started. Yeah. And it was just great. It was no fighting and no nothing. It was just, you know, everybody got along. We had the people who had the petting zoo, they pulled up and so the kids could have an animal. Somebody pulled up with a gaming truck and let the kids come on and play their games on the truck for free. An ice cream truck pulled up and gave a free ice cream. I mean, it was just amazing. So many people decided to come out and just be a blessing. And I wasn't even expecting none of that. I just thought we were going to come out and feed a couple hundred people, you know, like I said, 100, 150. That was it.
Wow.
But God,
but it ended up being a really nice event.
God shows you favor when you're honoring him. You know, when it's not about you, God will put you in places that you don't belong. You can't explain it. You can't rationalize it. You can't anything. Because God will show you favor when your goal is to glorify him, not you. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, people saw that. People know who you are. People know what you're about.
Right.
That's beautiful.
Right.
That's beautiful. And once again, I go back to, you know, what you said is some raw stuff. And there are people who have been through similar raw stuff, but they don't hear it. They hear light stuff.
Right.
This gentleman who I would love to interview, and I hope you hear this. His name is Bobby. Mm-hmm. Oh, God, I can't remember his last name right now. Kimbrough. Bobby Kimbrough. He is the he's the chief of police or something like that in Winston-Salem. And he said that his wife committed suicide as a result of using opioids, right? Now, he's out there fighting drugs on the street, and there's drugs in his house.
Wow.
And so what he did for like maybe 13 years is he told people his wife died of an aneurysm instead of telling them that she died of an opioid overdose.
And you know what? The last year I had went to a stop opioid and stop opioid and suicide child, you know, and something like that. I haven't seen the thing, but it was a stop opioid and suicide and children. And, you know, when I went there, first and foremost, I was the only black person there. So I was like, oh, Lord. But I was on a panel with the Indian doctors. It was in when I say these families came up as the grandmother, the mother, the father, their siblings. I mean, they brought their pets, the whole family, the neighbors, everybody came. But what they would do is they would say, my child died by suicide as an overdose on whatever drugs. And one lady said that her child still had the needle in his arm, but they all called it a suicide, not an overdose.
So it was almost like suicide was less stigmatizing than to say the child, like, actually was addicted to an, but see, what a lot of people don't know, and maybe this would help destigmatize this whole thing of addiction. Not that we're trying to glamorize it and make it cute, but it's just more like we want people talking about this thing so that they don't feel alone, because basically one thing begats another. Like guilt begats shame, which begats depression, which begats, here we go with suicidal ideations and perhaps, you know, the act itself. But it's something because, like 60%, I'm wondering if the number isn't higher. But years ago, when I was out in Wisconsin, rural Marshfield, Wisconsin, where I did my postdoc fellowship, 19,000 people, huge heroin epidemic, opioid epidemic out there. Huge, I mean, all the way down to high school using it, not just the adults. And it's a small town. So, like, after a while, stuff starts coming out because everybody knows everybody. That's part of what keeps the crime low, is because you be stealing from your neighbor who's your pastor. Or, you know what I'm saying, so like somebody you happen to be stealing from, somebody you work with, or, you know, you see at the gas station. But it's something because 60%, the research said years ago at least, that 60% of those who currently abuse heroin actually was first prescribed an opioid painkiller by a medical provider. Isn't that something?
Right.
And then they saw that
I just
maybe
trying to
they think. Used the drug. No, go ahead. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Yeah, I had texted y'all the picture I had took in front of the thing, so y'all could see what I'm talking about when it says stop opioid and child suicide or something. But yeah, I was just weird, because that's what Caucasian people say, my child died by suicide, because Marcy was the only one that wasn't on drugs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She was the only one there that wasn't, like, you know, on fentanyl or well, that's the biggest one.
Morphine.
Fentanyl and
morphine is another opiate that's commonly described.
And hydrocodone is another one these kids get, and it's a lot of them they get, and I'm like, wow.
Yeah, easily.
So
too,
I was
easily.
Shocked to hear that, but I didn't know that they said, you know, called, you know, drug overdose or suicide.
Right, so
because it shouldn't be considered. I guess they say accidental suicide. You know, if you put that word in front of it.
Remember, that was one of the categories. Accidental suicide is one of the leading causes of death right now. You know, people may think that they're taking it and they are invincible, you know, because you got... Look, those the kid during adolescence, the 12 to 21, you have the highest amount of gray matter mass on your brain, so you have the highest rate of, the highest probability of taking on more risk because you feel like you can overcome things. So they learn at a greater rate than we do, and they retain information more readily. So because they are learning rapidly, they are retaining information rapidly. They feel like they can be more agile. You know what I mean? Like if something happens or something starts to go awry, they can quickly change the situation. And that's a matter of having, like I said, once again, the greatest amount of gray matter mass and cognitive development at that stage. One of the things I also wanted to mention is I think that, well, we know that right now suicide is getting greater awareness because now they have a new 988 line that you can call if you're having suicidal ideations. And just this week, they passed the Public Safety Officer Support Act. Since 2017, over 750 police officers have died by suicide. So, you know, it's a trickle-down effect. You know, you've got the 988 suicide awareness line, right? You don't have to remember 1-800-SUICIDE or whatever it is. You got three digits to dial. You've also got the police officers who now are being, their families are now able to receive funding, you know, because if you die by suicide, the insurance does not cover it.
Right.
So now with this particular suicide act, the one case that they referenced was a gentleman who was a part of, I think it was the January 6th riot, and it was an officer who was accosted during the process, and the wife said after the riot, he came back with a split personality. He was completely different. And then shortly after shortly after the split personality. I can send you guys the link. I sent you the link, Dr. Valentina. Shortly after the split personality, he committed suicide. So that was one of the cases that they used. That was one of the stories that they used to prove the coexistence between trauma, PTSD, trauma, and suicide, and actually legitimizing it. So, you know, that would be interesting to see if this goes into play and we're even start to look at youth and trauma and what happens in those scenarios.
They did that huge study over in, I think it was California, through the Kaiser Permanente like hospital system with ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences acronym, where they basically, like, I forget how many hundreds of thousands of adults was a part of this study, but I just say 20,000. Well, no, I ain't going to say a number, but there's a tens of thousands of adults that was in this study where their childhood adverse child experiences were examined, and it basically it just showed the impact of it in their adulthood. So, like, you know, there's 10 that they identified. Most people, most Americans have one. Some have two, and then, you know, those who have four or more are at, like, basically sort of great concern. It's like great risk that there'll be homelessness or there'll be addictions to deal with or depression and suicidality. So, like, for example, I know a couple of them off the top of my head, like divorce is one adverse childhood experience. You know, surely a sexual trauma is another one, just as a physical abuse, you know, experience and emotional abuse. That's another one. So if you grew up feeling like you was dumb, like you was unloved, that too is an adverse child experience. Incarceration in your family, if somebody actually committed suicide, you know, so it's like, there or even maternal depression. Depression. A lot of mothers have depression, so even that was
probably go in some of the Maslow's hierarchy things, like the first level, second level of Maslow's hierarchy.
Yeah,
some of those probably tie in some kind of way to the ACEs.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So it's just really sad. Like, people end up, you know, because that stuff didn't get dealt with. That was the whole point of the study, is to identify these terrible things that happen in childhood and how when they aren't dealt with, then they kind of stay with you. That's the sucky thing about evil, is it happens, and if you don't deal with it, it stays with you even after it's happened, you know. And when you talk about the impact of trauma on suicidality, I mean, think about how people develop schizophrenia, you know, because of trauma. Like, that's what personality disorders, because of trauma. You know what I mean? People don't look at schizophrenia like that, and I guess it's because they're not televising it, because people only know pretty much what's in the media if they're not learning it in school. And so it's just a trip, like, you know, how, like, people don't really look at people with schizophrenia as having, you know, having experienced trauma. They look at PTSD because it's in a disorder, right? It's in a name. But even though, I mean, think about it. If a person was sexually abused, like, if you can't fight flight, you know, you're going to freeze. And when you freeze, typically that's when you dissociate and you go somewhere else in your mind so that you can escape the thing that's happening right now. That's why people be feeling like they're hovering over their body or they're somewhere else. But if you do that it's functional in that moment, but if you do it too many times, it becomes dysfunctional during a time where you feel like you're at risk, but really you're not at risk. Maybe you feel like you're at risk because the person looks like that other person. Well, because, like you said, she was afraid of men. She was afraid to go outside. She was afraid. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, then you start to use it even when there is no true risk, because now you associate all men with, you know, being dangerous. And so, you know, not that she had schizophrenia at all. She truly had PTSD and depression. But I'm just saying, this is how this stuff happens with even schizophrenia, is the person eventually, they start hallucinating. The stuff that helped them escape that terrible experience, they start to do it when they shouldn't be doing it. And now they're actually seeing stuff that's not there or hearing stuff that's not there, you know?
Right. And just the overlapping of conditions. Dr. Valentina, one of the things that I wanted to say is the thing that concerns me is that the remedy for one or the coping mechanism for one may not necessarily be the same as the coping mechanism for another person. And as
right.
our world become more diverse, like we're not living in rural America the way Elizabeth was blessed to grow up, where, you know, it's more homogeneous and, you know, people have the same values. We are living in a society
right.
where our next door neighbor or, you know, all the neighbors around us may not look like us, sound like us, dress like us, eat like us, dance like us, or anything like us. And
mm-hmm.
so their coping mechanism and
mm-hmm.
even their outward display can be very different. So for me to go to that doctor, right,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
that they would go to, that doctor might deem me as something different. And just to go a little bit further with that is, you know, as I said, I grew up in Parsippany, New Jersey, which was predominantly white.
Mm-hmm.
So the doctor that I go to, right, might
mm-hmm.
may or may not be a black doctor, but it will be a doctor that can relate to my upbringing, my environment, my social norms. So
oh,
if you
right,
put me
right.
with a doctor, if you put me with a doctor that says, oh, she's black and she's got to be this way, they may misdiagnose me. And I'll tell you this quick story really, really quickly. When I ran track, my coach, I went to Parsippany High, which is predominantly white. My coach said, oh, you need to run the 400 because, you know, basically all black people are sprinters. I ran that race.
Yeah.
I came to class for 2 years. For 2 years. I'm talking about there were seven people. I would come in seven. And then one day at practice, I was laughing and joking. I was talking, right? And I ran back. I kept running back and helping people. So I ran probably like 8 miles, and we were only supposed to run four. I mean, three, five. And they said, and my coach said, Kelly, you're a distance runner. Once she switched me to distance, I came in first and second in every single race. And
wow.
I wasn't even stressed about it. My coach would just tell me, beat this person. And I didn't know that person was going to come in first. The point that
wow.
I'm saying is, sometimes we generalize or over-assess based on our outward expectations of others,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but that may not be the cure or the coping mechanism that's best for that particular individual. So I like, Elizabeth, the fact that you were able to tell me your ritual, which
yes.
works for you, which
yes.
could be
right.
a pathway for some other people. You know, they may use that and tweak it, twist it a little bit to make it their customized, you know, coping mechanism. But part
right.
of the key is finding the person that you can relate to, finding the method that works for you, finding the exercise, finding the whatever it is, you know, the
right.
hokey pokey
yeah,
deal,
right.
whatever it may be that works for you,
right.
that gets you to your next place
mm-hmm.
of being. And if it doesn't work, don't be afraid to say, this ain't working. I'm going to
right.
behind door number two, door number three, door number four, door number five. And
right,
there are,
yeah.
right. you know, 50 options out there. You don't have to stay with door number one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, you're
Cinderella,
right.
Cinderella.
You're right.
Cinderella, get the shoe.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Be Cinderella, get the shoe and the man.
You're right, though. I love what you said about the whole coping strategies, because it is like this. Well, first of all, I love what you said about the misdiagnosis and making sure you don't just accept one diagnosis. I think that's for any potential situation. I mean, in this situation, it's clear cut, but that's true that there's some people who experience trauma, and it really should be deemed a PTSD. And like in Black people in particular, what a lot of non-Black and brown people don't know is that because our stress levels are so high, given the traps and all of the just bad things that happen to us, and the fact that it needs to be high for survival purposes, when then our scores come up high and they don't know that, then we're over-pathologized when really this was, you know, and then that's how you get a bunch of Black men who are misdiagnosed with schizophrenia, or Black women who are misdiagnosed with like bipolar disorder. And it's not that at all. It's some level of like anxiety or depression, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I love this, the piece about the whole coping strategies, because it's a trip. Like there are people who they just will tell you outright, like deep breathing doesn't work for me. And then you come to find out, you know, deep breathing is, that's like almost what you do when you stress. So, I mean, think about it, right? When you're stressed, like you almost
hyperventilate.
I don't know, it's almost like you're not breathing, like you're holding your breath such that your body forces you to, like, breathe, and then that's
right.
why it becomes
right.
deep. But really what I'm learning is that we've been getting it wrong, and so I'm not going to just outright say don't deep breathe, because some of my clients would say that has worked for them. But for the other 50% that says it doesn't, now I'm implementing what I've been learning recently as far as we really, like, think about it. When we're calm, our breath is kind of shallow. Like, we don't – the person next to us, including ourselves, can't even, like, hear ourselves breathe. Like, that's actually healthy. I mean, think about when the baby is sound asleep. That's why they say sleep like a baby. You know, because parents, new parents, we hover right over our baby. We trying to see if they body moving at least. Like, we try putting our ear next to their face, you know, to see if we hear something. And so that actually is how we should be programming ourselves to, like, in order to relax, which is another, again, coping strategy. You know, so is praying,
is
humming. A lot of people don't know that humming is a big coping strategy. Right? Like, they think listening to music, but it's even humming. Rocking, of course, we already know that's soothing, but nobody want to do that because they don't want to look, you know. But that's why some children, even with autism, like, self-regulating that way, because it really works. It's like being rocked.
Right.
Think about it, you know. So what are some of your, like, coping strategies? I know you mentioned faith was a big one. I think you mentioned family, too, right? Yes, right, Alyssa, you mentioned family, too, having your support system around you. What else? I know giving back to people, you were saying, has been huge. That's been helping you with overwhelming sin. Okay. What other things would you share?
I think giving back is, I think, you know, really being able to just, to, you know, my thing is being able to bless other people. And, you know, I don't really post what I do on Facebook because, it's kind of personal. I have a lot of women that are actually victims of either, and I don't just do suicide anymore. I have victims of domestic violence, and I have a few sex trafficking victims and gun violence.
Yeah.
So when they reach out to me and they tell me their stories, and, you know, and I'm getting text messages saying, hey, thank you, you saved my life, you're amazing. I mean, the stuff, even for my documentary, the feedback was just so amazing, and that's what keeps me going. You know, that's what keeps me okay. You know, the faith and the support, and like I said, I always make it about what would Marcy do, what would she want me to do, and I think that's just the biggest thing is to just, you know, I don't want to, you know, just make her look bad, because I am representing her. And her legacy, and I don't ever want to tarnish that. And that's just my biggest thing. But the messages I get, it's just so heartwarming and over. It's really, you know, the stuff it really makes me feel good to know I'm doing a good job. It really does.
Yeah.
And at those moments when you feel like, you know, I'm tired, I don't want to do anymore, you know, let somebody else handle it, then you get that one thank you, or you get that one call. Or you get that one aha moment, and it's like a turbo blast. It's like, you know, it boosts you to do what is deemed impossible because of that thank you. Seriously, because of that thank you, because somebody said thank you, or this is what I needed, or you see a difference. Not that you're doing it for the thank yous, but that thank you, that change shows you that you're not doing it in vain.
Couldn't say it better, right?
Yeah.
You know, and I just think I just like to see Black women and come together and get a sistership and then get a brothership, because we are really one of the only races that don't come together like we should, you know. And I see, like I said, even with all the different events I do, I see other races, they just come together, the fathers, the mothers, grandparents, sisters, brothers. I mean, we the only ones that's like kind of separated in a lot of stuff. And I want us to get that. And, you know, I don't know if y'all watch a lot of YouTube, but there are a lot of there are so many Black men getting these YouTube channels, and this is wrong with Black women. This is wrong with Black women. That's why, and you think somebody got to want you. I mean, the stuff that they say is just like, wow, you know, and women call in, and I always think, why would you call in and let somebody talk to you that way? You know, it's a lot of people that emulate that. Kevin Samuels, even though he's deceased now, but a lot of people, they just—I know he grew a big fan base.
Elizabeth, you know what? I was gonna say one of the challenges is that with African American females, we hold on to things, and I'm only saying this in comparison from the students that I work with and me growing up in Parsippany, New Jersey. When something happens, you say it, it's out, and you let it go. That we don't hold on to things. where my grandmother grew up, there were people who went to the Methodist church and the Baptist church that didn't talk to each other just because they went to the other church. It happened when my mother was growing up. It happened when I was growing up. So that's at least two generations of people. Methodist church, the Methodist church, the Baptist church. Come on, really?
I mean, this is historical. Like, what y'all are bringing up is a whole nother session or meeting because, I mean, this is historical. Think about how our people were pegged against each other. The house slave versus the field slave. Like, the fact that, like, we're not from England. We're not English people. Like, you know, I mean, just say what it is. Like, our language was stripped from us, our identity, you know what I'm saying, our names, like this kind of stuff causes us to then identify. When we have something, we hold on to it. And so I think that's why it'd be some silly, petty-like stuff that don't make sense because it's kind of like a person who argues in a relationship over something that seems dumb. Well, it's because it's been added up and all the, right? And this little thing is just one more thing that this person just disregarded you on in your relationship that you see. So it's like, it seems petty, but it's deeper and bigger. And it's sad. Mm-hmm. It is sad that we're divided, but if we could just get to the root of like why this is happening, then we can move past it, you know? And because right now it's like for real, and you talking about Bible, like we in a slumber, like we sleep, like for real, you know, like walking dead, like for real.
Right. We need.
And
to
a lot of that comes from the childhood trauma that they never get justice for, or you know, it starts and ends at home. So when you don't get your help as a child, it just you know the domino effect.
I mean,
you take his own and then.
Yes. I mean, literally, we just talked about ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, you hitting on it, and that's literally, it reminds me of the whole, is it PTSS? Like, instead of PTSD, where we say post-traumatic stress disorder, it's this psychologist, black psychologist, she called it PTSS as far as post-traumatic slave syndrome, where it's like the repercussions.
Mm-hmm.
of what occurred, you know what I'm saying, a century ago, it's still with us because it's literally, like literally, talking about chitlins, like that's a slave food, chitlins, think about it, why are we eating pig and first of all, why are we eating pig at all, but pig intestines, like, yuck, if you have to put hot sauce on something and it stink after you cook it and season it and just to eat it, that's a sign that you probably shouldn't be eating, you know?
Right. That's
now, look, I got some chitlins right in front of me right now I'm about to throw down. Don't be talking
disgusting.
About my donuts.
Disgusting.
I'm just kidding.
I knew you were. You know
but
I
there,
knew
but there, you know, there are some
but
listeners, there are some listeners who like it. There are some listeners who like it, so I'm not going to discredit it. But what I am going to say is you need to know we're off the air. Because we ended at 11:30.
I was like, man, I got to get ready to go. And I don't want to just leave. We didn't even say our byes and stuff.
Well, let me say this. We're off the air, but I think if somebody gets the recording of this, they can still hear everything that we're saying right now. What I do want to say is that I did pray before this particular conversation because I was really nervous about it. And the reason why I was nervous about it is because when I was teaching, kids would come up to me and talk about suicide the way we talk about what shoes are you going to wear today. And I think they're numb in some ways as to, you know, really and truly the mortality that's related to it and also the void that will be left if they are no longer here. So I pray that those two could be conveyed, that, you know, that the seriousness of their acts could be conveyed, and that, once again, the void for the ones that are left behind, for the parents. And I think that they did this. I think that you guys did a phenomenal job. So I just want to say thank you for answering my prayer.
Thank you.
And I believe that we will bless families along the way. I also want to just thank really quickly, Kim Justice, for allowing us to have this opportunity. I want to thank Terry Smith, who's one of my fellow hosts on the Brain Injury Radio Network. He has a phenomenal show, and every single time I forget the name of his show, please forgive me, but he is phenomenal. If you look him up on the Brain Injury Network, Terry Smith, you'll see his show. I want to thank Marcus Boyd, who is someone who is a PTS survivor and an individual with autism who has several Grammy Awards, who actually gave us the beats for this show. I want to thank you, Elizabeth, for being our guest today, and once again for your authenticity.
Thank you.
Your transparency, and your willingness to fight the fight for so many out there who really need you. And I'm talking about from presidents to clinicians to survivors to grievers. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Dr. Valentina, you are just off the chain every show. So I thank God there's nothing but God just coming in and like Kool-Aid, adding water and stir, because you bring it every show. And I thank you for your energy, for your passion, your commitment to do this, because we are volunteering. We don't get any money for this. We're doing it out of a love and a concern for people, enabling them to move forward, move beyond situations, and find their pathway to triumph. So, once again, guys, thank you so much for being a blessing, and I wish you guys
Yes, thank you. You are excellent.
Yes.
Great host. Always know the right questions. I mean, just know how to pull. It's just wonderful. Just wonderful. You have a great gift, Coach. Great gift.
Yeah.
Thank you. I want y'all to know I paid Dr. Valentina to say that the check is in the mail, girl.
No, she didn't. Okay. I'll wait for that then. You're so funny.
Good
night,
everyone. Thank
you for everything. Good night. We'll be in touch. Good night.
Thank you guys, too. All right. Oh, and tell, please, can she tell of her really quickly? Can she just, I was going to say, see you in the end of September. Can you just say that really quickly, Elizabeth, about your award or achievement ceremony?
Please.
Oh, yes. I changed my I'm getting a Presidential Lifetime Achievement Award. Michelle Obama nominated me for it because of everything I do. And the Biden administration, either him, Kamala, or somebody from his administration will present me with the award.
Wow. Incredible. Mm-hmm. I'll be there.
Yep.
It's September 30th. Maybe you could give somebody, just remind them of your website or how they can potentially, like, tune in if they wanted to come.
I don't know my website. It's by heart, but I'm on Facebook as Elizabeth Gerald, G-E-R-A-L-D, and then there's a TF for Team Family on Facebook. Once again, Elizabeth Gerald, TF, and it's like a comic book picture. Then I have an MJG Movement page, and on Twitter, I have MJG Movement. Or just Google M-A-R-C-I-E-G-E-R-A-L-D, and a lot of that will come up.
There you go, Marcy Gerald. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
perfect.
Don't forget the little people a shout out when you talk to Michelle. Tell her about me.
I know.
Okay.
It's so funny.
Me and Dr. Dane. Thank you again for everything. I will send you.
Yeah.
If you don't have the link, I'll send you the link so that you can also add this to your Facebook page.
Perfect.
Okay.
All right.
Perfect.
Guys, be blessed. Take care.
All right. Have a wonderful
too.
Night, ladies.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Mm-hmm.